Hello everyone, welcome to concurrent session 4F, using economic capital to manage a bank and beyond. My name is Chow, I'm the Secretary of the Banking Practice Committee. Today's presentation will be given by Philip Everett and Sen Nagarajan. Before I start, I'd like to remind you to please fill out your presenter feedback form, and if you'd like to ask a question, please use the microphone in the middle and state your name and other organisational information before you commence asking a question. Let me introduce our two presenters today. Philip Everett. Philip is currently the head of Group Capital and Pricing Intelligence at NAB. His role involves working across the business to optimise reward for risk capability and the capital position for the group. Philip has previously worked in similar roles within the business banking division of NAB, as well as running pricing and product management areas in different parts of the NAB group. Prior to becoming a banker, Philip worked in superannuation and other actuarial consulting before joining Plum, a large corporate supermaster trust, who are part of the same in the wealth management division of NAB. Philip has an active interest in opening doors for actuaries in the banking industry. He's currently the convener of the Actuaries Institute Banking Practice Committee. Phil holds a mathematical science degree in economics and statistics at the University of Adelaide. He has a diploma of financial planning, is a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries of Australia, and was awarded the CERA qualification as a leading practitioner in 2012. Sen Nagarajan. Sen is manager at Deloitte Actuaries and Consultants. At Deloitte, Sen has worked on a number of projects across banking, analytics, and risk management. Prior to joining Deloitte, Sen ran the economics capital team at a major Australian bank. Sen's responsibilities included developing economic capital models, managing the economic capital reporting and forecasting process, and embedding the use of economic capital and risk-adjusted performance measures across the bank. Prior to moving into banking, Sen has held a number of roles in life insurance actuarial. He has experience in life insurance pricing, valuation, and capital management both in Australia and in the UK. Sen has an honours degree in actuarial studies from the ANU and is a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries of Australia. He also holds an FRM designation from the Global Association of Risk Professionals. Sen is a member of the Institute of Actuaries Banking Practice Committee, as well as the Research Subcommittee of the Actuaries Institute Risk Management Practice Committee. So without further ado, please welcome our two presenters, Philip Everett and Sen Nagarajan.
Yeah, thanks, Chow. Hopefully I can master the technology here. So it's a fairly small group, so we'll be reasonably informal today. So we'll Sen and myself will go through the presentation reasonably quickly and then open up for questions. Look, economic capital is an interesting topic. I think about economic capital as the best tool in your shed. You know, on the weekends I do a bit of DIY and I think, what's the best tool? Is it an angle grinder or the cordless drill? But I feel economic capital is like your cordless drill. You know, can do pretty well everything. Gives you lots of useful insight and information, probably beyond a lot of the other tools that the actuaries in the bank have. So going on to that, you know, interestingly, just bear with me. Sorry about this. So as a lot of people here would know, banks are fairly focused on capital. One of the most interesting things I noticed when I joined the bank from the wealth management area of the bank in about 2006 was how much focus there was on ROE, how much focus there was on the capital position. And so we've been looking at capital and ROE as a key metric in the bank for, you know, 10, 15 years. I think there's the stuff that's starting to emerge in insurers and things in different levels. Interestingly, the banks have been using ECAP probably, you know, on and off probably for the last 15 years, and we'll talk a bit about that today, how the focus on economic capital has, you know, gone up and down, and there's some of the arguments for and against using it. And at the end of the presentation, we'll talk a little bit about, you know, some of the emerging opportunities within the LAGIC framework, and Sen will talk about some of the parallels that we're seeing from some of the history that we've been through in the banking industry. So, Sen, do you want to take over?
Wonderful. So I'd like to start off with a bit about what is economic capital. Essentially, it's a measure of unexpected loss. So you're looking at, you know what your expected loss is going to be. So if you're talking about credit risk, it might be your expected level of defaults. But in economic capital, you're wondering at a target level of confidence, what's the loss that you'll get? So very similar to a concept like VAR. Key things about EC principles are you need a time horizon, you need to define the risk, you need to have a confidence level, and then once you have your distribution, you can sort of work out what the EC is. So regulatory capital and banking. Do you want to start off, Phil? Or?
Yeah, sure.
Yep.
Is this working, Chair? Yeah, so look, let's step back in time to 2005. In 2005, we were in a situation where we had a scenario known as Basel I. I think we're up to about Basel IV coming up. But Basel I was really simple. It was just designed to ensure there was enough capital around. And some of the drivers for Basel I were mortgages would have a lower risk weight than a corporate loan. Local governments and governments would have a lower risk weight than a corporate. So there were some fairly simple risk weights being applied to loans. Interestingly, in this environment, that wasn't measuring risk. So the bank said, OK, this is about making sure there's enough capital in the system to keep APRA happy and make sure that we're solvent. But in reality, we want to select our risks a bit better and we build economic capital models. So those economic capital models, you know, they measured things like the customer chances of going under. When the customer goes under, how much we would lose, what were we exposed to, and also concentration of the portfolio. And that was a really big thing. Some of the correlations that we were capturing through economic capital were things that were, and are still not, captured through a lot of the regulatory capital measures. So just bear with me a second.
Right, and then Basel II came in back in 2008, and that literally threw a spanner in the works, or a cordless drill if you prefer, Phil. But what happened was it blurred the lines between economic capital and regulatory capital. So where you had this nice, easy relationship where you had a very broad brush regulatory capital approach and your more risk-sensitive economic capital approach, Basel II did two things. It made regulatory capital very very risk-sensitive, and secondly, push the level of capital up. So when you've got regulatory capital being so risk-sensitive, and I'll talk about the credit risk component a bit more, people questioned why you would need another measure like economic capital. And secondly, push the level of capital up. So where previously you might have had situations where regulatory capital understated the risk because it was so broad and simplistic, now, almost certainly, regulatory capital was biting. And that level of capital has continued to increase over time. So after the GFC, you had strengthening of certain parts of the regulatory capital regime for banks. So things like market risk capital, the CVA capital for derivatives in the banking book, as well as the things such as the counter-cyclical buffer that came in and the D-SIB buffer. So that basically, banks have been hit again and again. Regulatory capital is pretty much the binding constraint for most banks. And so there's a question, why would you ever rely on economic capital? Why not manage to the capital regime that's driving the overall level of capital that the group holds? The second thing that happened was when Basel II came in, a lot of the modelling capability and the resources that you had building and running these models were diverted to developing the internal models for Basel II. So under Basel II, you have the option of developing and using your own internal models for risk, credit risk factors, things like the PD and LGD that Phil mentioned earlier. So effectively, economic capital lost a bit of focus. And we sort of used the terminology, a religion of Basel II regulatory capital developed, where people thought, well, we don't need economic capital, we'll just focus on one measure. So we'll talk a little bit about the Basel II regulatory capital formula for credit risk and why it became more risk-sensitive and a little bit about it. Basically, for credit risk, so now we're getting a little bit technical, we are interested in a portfolio loss measure. So you've got a massive portfolio of loans that some of which will go default, and the rate at which they go default can vary over time. So key things are, in addition to the characteristics of individual obligors, how they're related. And one way you could do it is to have a correlation matrix, but as it would be obvious, when you have more than a handful of companies, you're going to get hundreds of correlations that you need to estimate, and it becomes impossible, basically. So what banks did in economic capital models is to use factors. So obligors are correlated to a factor in the economy. It could be like an industry index. And that simplified the modeling quite a bit. In the Basel II formula, it starts off with a one-factor model. So that formula there is the value of the company's asset is related to a systemic factor Y, which is like the broader macroeconomic conditions, and an idiosyncratic factor. And basically, when you do the maths and you make assumptions like we've got a really big portfolio with thousands of obligors and we don't have concentrations in one, the idiosyncratic factor drops out, and you can get a nice analytical formula for capital, which is what we've got on the next page. So this is the Basel II credit risk capital formula for a business loan. There's quite a lot of stuff on there, but really the important part is the second line, which says that K is equal to LGD, which is loss given default. So if an obligor defaults, that's what you're going to lose. And then you've got PD, which is probability of default, which is what's the probability someone will default. And then the other constants there, you've got R, which is the systemic correlation. You've got M, which is maturity, so how long the loan is. And this formula captures most of the key dynamics that you need for capital. So it's got, you know, what's the rate of companies default, what's the loss if you default. The 0.991 is because Basel's calibrated at a 1 in 1,000 year scenario or loss confidence level. You've got M, so the longer the maturity, the longer it's going to be on your books and the more likely you're going to make a loss. And then the rest of it, what Basel did was they used some of the common models that were around at the time to calibrate it to make sure that it's realistic. And you have R as well, that's the correlation to the macro factor. Basically, the correlation depends on things such as the size of the borrower. So bigger borrowers tend to not default very often, but they default particularly during stressful times. So they're counterintuitively, they're actually more systemically important. And when you think about a borrower like a sovereign, like a, you know, a government, then they're very systemically correlated, but they're very low risk. So it's a counterintuitive thing that sometimes you have to explain when you work in this area. And this is just a illustration of how the capital changes. So I've just plotted in the capital curve for different probabilities of default corresponding to credit grades and different LGDs. I think that's over a three-year horizon. But you can see, obviously, as the loan gets more, as the loan gets more risky, it seems to have more capital. So all's good. So it seems it's a fairly risk-sensitive measure. And with that, I'll hand over to Phil.
So that's a pretty impressive formula, you know. Or so the so we just go back to how do you go back? I think it's. So in the bank, in a lot of the banks, when you show this to people, there's some people go, wow, and they're mind blown. But actually, you know, Sen's just outlined there's a lot of shortcomings to this. And look, it's a very good, elegant way to do it, but in reality there are some shortcomings to this, and we'll just go through some of those and why there's probably an illusion of accuracy given by this. So if we just go forward, just bear with me. Oh, hang on, sorry, I've gone too far the wrong way. So. Yeah, so some of the things that Sen mentioned before were that the term. So we talked about the maturity of the loan. What's interesting is that the Basel formula chooses between 1 year and 5 years. And in fact, for some of the retail exposures, there is no difference for term, which is interesting. So a 30-year loan can have the same risk according to this as a 5-year loan. Do we really believe that? Interesting question. And I think the other thing is the correlation in the regulatory capital. It depends on size. It doesn't depend on the characteristics of the individual organisation. So, again, you might not be capturing the way that that company might be correlated to the economy. It could vary by the industry. Certain industries may be more correlated to economic circumstances than others. It doesn't capture concentration. Again, we're trying to assume average capital for a portfolio of fully diversified assets. And again, if you've got too much of something, obviously you should hold more capital, because in a downturn you're going to be in a scenario where you're going to lose more. So you can see there, the graph there, that we've got different industry correlations that we often capture in our ECAP. Interestingly, the other thing that's really interesting when you see the shape of economic capital curves across most banks, and this is not just in Australia, internationally you find there's a steeper shape of the curve relative to the regulatory capital formula. And so what that shows is that if you were going to rely on your regulatory capital and others were relying on the economic capital to price, you would actually be pricing too low at the worst end and too high at the better end. So in other words, you're going to get selected against. So it's quite interesting. It's just good information about your risk that the formula, just by its nature, is not capturing. In addition, there are differences of the confidence interval. We talked about the regulatory capital confidence interval is 99.9% versus whatever it might be. So typically an Australian bank, one of the large fours would be AA rated. That would be a 99.97% equivalent would be the standard. All right. Another interesting scenario is what we call slotting or specialised lending. In this scenario, the regulators have said, look, you can't build models. You know, corporate real estate, certain project finance, we don't think you can build models. So we're going to actually throw your exposures into risk grades and have a risk weight of 70%, 90%, 100%, whatever it is. So again, you know, this scenario is actually quite penal versus the economic capital, and actually even penal versus the standard Basel formula. Other things where the regulators have actually made adjustments are mortgages, 20% floor on loss given default. And there's APRA's view that there could be a downturn in the housing market. It's probably not a wrong assertion at present, but I won't let you comment too much on that, James. Interestingly, in New Zealand, there's been a lot of messing around with the formula. So RBNZ has been extremely active in this space. They've actually put overlays for dairy, recognising the concentration of dairy in New Zealand, and they've actually also played around with the correlations for mortgages representing, you know, where there's a higher percentage of the amount that the customers have borrowed, they've got higher correlations in the formula to recognise higher risk. So in a way, it's interesting, the RBNZ has probably been ahead of the curve, looking at where there might be risk and actually trying to capture it. These are all things that most banks with ECAP models would have already predicted. And Basel IV is around the corner. So just what we call in the industry Basel IV is standardised risk weights. So essentially from the formula where it was a nice, smooth risk-based curve, what they're looking to do is producing sort of a series of risk weights which vary very broadly by a number of factors such as loan-to-value ratio and you know, ability to service the debt. But it's not really that risk-based, and interestingly, there's a lot of discussion around the industry about that. But with that coming, you're going to need a more of a risk-based measure. Economic capital will be that measure.
So we had a bit of a discussion of credit and how economic capital defers to regulatory capital. Same thing happens on the other risk types. So the regulatory capital regime has specific capital requirements across market risk, operational risk, and interest rate risk in the banking book, which could be considered another form of market risk, which is the matching position of the bank's balance sheet. Basically, if you are a bank that's accredited to use your internal models, you can use fairly sophisticated models for these. But APRA or most regulators will have restrictions on what you can recognise. One of the key restrictions is the amount of diversification that you can recognise, both within the risk and between the other risk type, between the risk types, so intra and inter-risk diversification. The other ways that your models can differ is things that you can recognise that reflect the bank's management practices in managing those risks. So some banks could, for market risk, have an allowance for the fact that they have stop-loss limits or practices that limit their exposure during high volatility periods. In operational risks, you might be able to mitigate it using insurance contracts, which APRA might not allow you to recognize. An example under interest rate risk in the banking book, APRA has restrictions such as your free cash flow. You've got to assume that it's available right away. But banks don't invest their free capital in cash. They invest it probably in a 3 to 5 year or more term because they recognize that that capital is not going to be needed immediately. So that gives a higher regulatory capital for interest rate risk in the banking book. So the same sort of situation happens in other risk types where if you're an advanced bank that can use your own internal models, it looks like it's fairly risk sensitive, but there are some areas where it doesn't capture it. One of the key points that that we make about economic capital is that it's equivalent between risk types. So it's referred to as a common currency of risk. And when you're measuring exposures, when you're trying to calculate return on things, the nice property about economic capital is that it's you can apply it across risk types, across products, and so it becomes quite a useful measure. And because I'll hand over to Phil now to talk about the real point that we're trying to get to, which is...
So at the end of the day, it's all about shareholder value. How do we generate shareholder value from economic capital? Really, it does come down to a number of key things that we've talked about with economic capital, capturing variability and extra information about your risk. So what's really interesting, if you were to model through some sort of projection calculator what the ROE will be over the history of a loan or a transaction of some other kind, what will come out will be depending on the assumptions you put in. So typically what we say to a person in our bank is if you actually model the ROE on the assumptions in the Basel formula, will those assumptions play out in practice? And the economic capital, we say, gives them extra information which will enable them to pick for the same ROE today which way it will go in terms of way it evolves over time. So there's extra information in there that shows over time how will the ROE evolve if you use the economic capital measure for the reasons that we outlined previously. I think the other thing is it's actually, clear. If we go down to another slide here, one of the other things which is really clear is that it captures the concentration and also captures the correlation with the economy. So in doing that, I think what you do is you also capture, your variability of cash flows. And, going to standard, corporate finance theory, more volatility, actually is valued less than less volatility. And so in a sense that this is captured, there is a lot more value to the shareholder in a more stable portfolio.
So you might be saying that's all good, Phil, but surely you can use regulatory capital in that formula, and shouldn't it be good enough? It's risk sensitive. You've captured most of your risk and key dynamics. But actually, the point that we're trying to make is that regulatory capital was never designed to be at the granular level, and its key purpose was to be applied across all the banks in the system. It's there more to protect deposit holders and maintain the stability of the system and provide for adequate capital at the group level. But when you start going from the group level to more granular levels, then you've got to be using your best measure of capital, particularly as you said, when you go down to business unit level, then the differences between your institutional and the distribution that you get versus your retail become important. When you start to go down to pricing, then some of those factors that Phil talked about that result in you having hidden value or excess value become very important. You can very quickly go out and accumulate business in those areas of hidden risk and not take business in the areas of hidden value. And we sort of noted some of those. For example, long-term loans, because the formula is capped at 5 years, you could end up going and doing a whole lot of long-term loans if you do not price for that risk. Sovereign risk is another one. So the systemic correlation within the Basel formula doesn't recognize that sometimes sovereigns are very highly correlated in the portfolio. And single name concentration. So it doesn't recognize that you could all of a sudden have big exposures to a few single names, which actually drives up the tail of your distribution and the risk that you have. And then there's the opposite, where you wouldn't capture short-term loans because there's a one-year floor in the Basel formula. The mortgages, given the 20% floor, and highly rated commercial property borrowers. So Phil mentioned slotting, which has a very penal regime for commercial property exposures. But there are some classes of property borrowers who are actually quite good risks. For example, you would treat real estate trusts the same as a sort of a small developer who builds shopping centers, and they're both very different risks. And so just to reinforce why economic capital is a critical tool in the management of a bank.
So again, that's all great. You know, that's all great. We have to have economic capital, but my regulatory capital is, you know, a whole lot higher. So that's what I should use. That's often what we hear. So, and, you know, that's a fairly sensible argument on the face of it, but in reality, you know, we've just got a really interesting situation here. If we say just because it's higher that we should use that to pick our risk, is that the right argument? So typically what banks have been doing in this scenario around the world has been actually coming up with practical solutions to say, okay, for whatever reason, Basel and APRA and whatever regulators are in play have asked us to hold $100 of capital. Our economic capital might be $85, but the economic capital is still giving us information. So what they're using the economic capital to do is actually to spread or allocate that capital, and that's typically a practice around the world. There are lots of practical ways banks do that. Some banks choose to allocate the whole amount of capital across the whole portfolio and potentially subsidise some parts with others. Others actually take strategic pools where there are similar relationships between the regulatory capital implied by the risk-weighted assets and the economic capital, and using that to allocate within those pools. But the general consensus for best practice is, you know, you do have to have a hybrid. You can't just say economic capital only or regulatory capital only. ISEPM, who I'm not sure if people know who they are, but they're the International Association of Credit Portfolio Managers, had just put out a survey for banks and said, what's your planned operation in terms of reg capital versus economic capital over the next couple of years? And about 60% are saying that they want to use a hybrid measure, which is of the type we've talked about. So in terms of managing a bank, you know, some of the ways that it's used, people will be familiar with some of these, both within a bank and other organisations. Pricing is one that comes to mind, ICAP, and that is used to various extents within ICAP, but it's a major contributor to ICAP, especially given ICAP is an internal measure. Others are actually risk appetite in setting limits. And the value of economic capital in a lot of managing a bank, especially when you've got a diverse organisation, is, as Sen said, it's common currency of risk. So, you know, we know how much wealth risk is worth, how much general insurance risk could be if you've got a conglomerate. But it is interesting, there are varying degrees to which each bank does use it, and I don't think there is a single bank that uses it in all of these in Australia, and there's very few in the world that use it in all, but they all do use it to varying extents. I know that when Sen was at CBA, they used it in things that my bank doesn't use it in, and we use it in areas they don't use it in. So it's an interesting evolution in this space.
Right, so economic capital beyond banking. One of the things that we sort of observe is that there's some parallels to LAGIC. So there's a new regime that came in for life and general insurers. Again, similar to Basel, there is a standardised approach with a set of calculations to determine the requirement, and there is, within the framework, opportunity to develop internal models to calculate capital requirements. And one of the things that we're curious about is, if you were on the prescribed calculations, does that capture the risk effectively? The other question is, how widely used is economic capital for insurance companies? I guess our sort of observation, and this you may have a comment on this, is that it's not as widely used as in banking. One factor could be that the implementation itself of Logic has diverted the focus, similar to when Basel II came in about 7 years ago. And so perhaps the next step is the development of economic capital models. It remains to be seen whether insurers who have good economic capital models will have an advantage. In terms of the use of EC in insurance companies, I'm aware that some companies do use economic capital to help determine the target surplus, which is kind of consistent with what APRA expects, I guess, based on CPG 110. However, we're not aware of too many companies that use economic capital in pricing, and it tends to be regulatory capital that's used as a driver. It's probably fair to say for some of the subsidiaries of the banks, economic capital is probably used to measure at least the insurance division as a whole, and so they're probably economic capital models in place. But I guess in conclusion, in this topic, it would be interesting to see whether there would be further development of economic capital and how valuable it is from an insurance perspective, and whether it will mirror the take-up that we've seen in banking. And that brings us to the formal part of our presentation. So we'll open it to questions and comments.
Thank you very much. This is a fantastic presentation. Please put your hands together to congratulate our presenters. I'd like to remind you that if you'd like to ask a question, please use the microphone in the middle, and please speak clearly to the microphone and identify yourself before asking a question. I will start with the first question. My name is Chow Chow, and I'm from PricewaterhouseCoopers. Thank you for this presentation on economic capital. What do you think are some of the advantages actuaries have in bringing value to banks, especially in this field of economic capital?
Oh, wow. Look, I've got a few. I think the best things that actuaries bring to these problems are the ability to make it clear to people, you know, why it is from a commercial perspective. So I think it's easy to come up with a capital model and say, you know, the capital says 25, but I think it says 25 and this is how you use it, how you apply it, what it means for your business is the area that I think the actuaries can really help. You know, I used to find that the best example is the risk guys could come up with here's the capital model, but that's interesting, but what do you do with it? How do you put it in your pricing tools? How do you make it real to people in the business and what the decision-making points they have, and how can you just sort of break it down into simple terms? So that's my perspective. What about you, Sen?
I agree. I think actuaries have a strong advantage in this area, actually. When you think about it, as an actuary, you're trained to use quantitative techniques and within a business setting. And compared to some of the other people or some of the other professions that work in this area, I think actuaries are very good at looking at the end-to-end, which for economic capital is really important. So not just what's the model telling you and what are your inputs and is it statistically correct, but also what's the downstream impact for your business plan within your pricing system. So actuaries have, I guess, that experience and that training to apply that holistically across the business. Even simple things like analysis of change, which is a natural thing for actuaries, but it's actually something new for non-actuarial quant professionals. Oh, you can, you know, change one assumption at a time, and that gives you a nice waterfall to explain how your capital changes. So definitely, I think there are a lot of advantages that actuaries can bring.
There's probably one other key point that I think it's worth putting on the table. If you look at a lot of banks, they're massive, massive organisations, and you typically find very big risk functions, very big treasury functions and very big finance functions, but not many people know how the pieces fit together. and to use economic capital often requires that, and actuaries are well placed to do that. You know, similar to what actuaries do in insurance, where they're across pretty well everything, it's the same opportunity, the ability to understand how all those bits fit together.
James Hickey from Deloitte. Guys, a question. Economic capital models, I understand, require a lot of data. Is a challenge for Australian banks that we haven't got the depth of data, even across individually our big four banks, say across the mortgage pools especially, because the losses have been quite benign relative to global instances, and is that potentially why the regulators say, well, guys, you can build these nice economic capital models, but you simply haven't had the negative property movements and losses that other jurisdictions have had, therefore we want to set the hurdle higher. And the regulators aren't hiding the nothing, because if you set your capital too low and a systemic issue happens, then everyone's caught short. And second part to that question is that why sometimes the insurance entities don't use economic capital, simply because the volume of data around the risk insurance losses is simply not there? Obviously, if you had big PAR books and you had asset liability risk, yes, you could use economic capital modelling, but for insurance risk, there simply may not be the data to mine.
That's a good question, James. I think the data hasn't been a significant issue, because even for regulatory capital, in order to come up with your PD and LGD, APRA requires you to have fairly significant amounts of data and also overlay that with what you might think would happen in an economic downturn if your data doesn't capture one. From an economic capital for at least credit risk and market risk leverages that data set. I think the reason it's higher is to, one, as a measure of conservatism, and secondly, just to make sure that companies aren't given too free rein to have, capture some of the sort of management decisions or diversifications which are harder to quantify. Coming back to insurance, I think it may not have the same level of data, so some of the big banks have lost data that goes back to the early 90s. So in insurance, you might not have the same level of data on claims, but I don't think that should be a reason itself to not use a more risk-sensitive measure or rely on economic capital. That answers your question.
Just on that, James, so I've got a guy building a retail model and he's got 14 years of mortgage losses in Australia. It's different elsewhere, but interestingly, though, when Basel II did come in, a lot of the banks didn't have all the data at hand. Some did, some didn't. And so, you know, it wasn't atypical to have old retired credit managers going through files and, you know, getting the data to help through. So the data is always a challenge, but it's just, you know, to what extent you do overlays to that data as well, yeah. But I think the interesting thing is this, what we try and use it for is to capture more information about what we think the losses could be than is implied in some of the formula. So, and, you know, the same challenges in coming up with your PDs and LGDs are there, like Sen said, but it's just there's more information that you can use to be more granular in your risk selection, I think, that you can draw out of your ECAP models. So, yeah, data is always a challenge, but, you know, I think for the big four, you'll probably find there's enough data. I think where it gets interesting is beyond into the standardised banks and the smaller providers. You know, they all sometimes want to build ECAP models, and I think a lot of regulators say, guys, do you really think you can build an ECAP model around the world to some of these small providers? It's not just because of the data, it's the do they have the expertise, the ability to maintain it, etc. So it's the same challenge, I think, in the smaller providers than it might be for some of the smaller insurers too.
Hi, Mike Callan, Monash University. What do you do if your model shows your economic capital exceeds the regulatory capital?
Well, if that's the case, you probably need to hold more capital.
Message that you would give to the management if you're talking about actuaries coming in, figuring out there's more risks than the regulatory and you determine there's a higher amount of capital.
Yeah.
My experience of working in the capital side is
it's that gets
brushed away.
Yeah. Look, typically, it's not a problem we're facing in most of the banks at present, I would say, given that there's a lot of extra buffers that are getting put in. But, you know, there is a scenario, given that it's a more extreme measure, often with the higher confidence intervals, that in a stress scenario it could be above it. So in that case, if you are doing a proper internal assessment, and you're using ECAP, then it's really hard for management to ignore that, I would say, yeah. I haven't had that, discussion yet, but in that scenario, I would expect that you would have to say to them, look, there is more risk you're being exposed to. Do you really think your capital really is adequate? Do we believe our models? And that's the sort of question you'd have to go through, yeah. Have you had that one, Sin?
I can't say I have. No, that would be a tough message, and I think Phil's pretty right there. I mean, if you're sure that you've captured all the risks correctly, then that's something that needs to be highlighted to management. And it's not just from economic capital versus regulatory capital. If there is something in your portfolio that's driving up high economic capital, that could potentially be something that the rating agencies are likely to pick up if it's higher concentration in some of the lower quality areas. So it's something that you'd need to hold more capital and communicate it clearly to management and the regulator.
Belinda Sutcliffe from ANZ. If I think about our big four banks at the moment, they are businesses that are a mixture of banking and wealth. Regulatory capital very different, and almost never the twain. So my question is, do you think level three capital requirements will actually change the status of economic capital?
That's a good question. If level three eventuates, the interesting thing is level three is actually required. What's been good about it is actually required you to actually put certain economic capital against certain entities, which I think was a good outcome. So some of the non-regulated entities that didn't have APRA measured capital now have to have economic capital as a measure, which is interesting. So all of a sudden you've got this bizarre hybrid where you've got risk-weighted asset type capital in banks, which is prescribed according to the Basel formula, your LAGIC capital for the insurance parts of it, and then these sort of funds management and other activities which you've got an economic capital. So in my mind, that's a bizarre mixed bag. And you know, in some respects, if anything, my view is that economic capital makes more sense in that scenario, actually, because level three is actually meant to be, you know, equal rather than, you know, different regs. And that's what the intention was, but not sure that it's been achieved yet. Not sure it's going to come in either, but we'll see on that one. Anything on that?
Phil, the comment about LMI, is that a challenge for the future sustainability of LMI providers? Because the reg capital effectively puts 20% floor on, regardless of whether you require the borrower to purchase LMI. They're obviously, that will come into your economic cap model, but not into your reg capital model. Does that pose a challenge for the viability going forward of LMI providers if they're not getting capital recognition?
It just, I think, for the bank itself, it just tells you where it's better risk where you've got LMI and not. So again, it's the value versus the reg capital. I mean, that's the only difference I can think of it with LMI. But, you know, I probably won't go too far into that LMI question like we had last year, James. But, yeah.
Any other questions? Probably have time for another one or two questions. Questions or comments? Nope, going once, going twice. Okay, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Please join me in thanking our two presenters.